Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfectly Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Engine. This is episode 37 for October 26, 2012. I'm actually planning these out so I know exactly when this is going to drop, as they say. Nice. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Mr. Cole Hornaday.
Hey there.
This is Nicole Lamb. Who just took a drink of water right when I introduced her. And Mr. Chris Casso.
Hello.
Alrighty, so how is everybody this evening?
37 episodes, really?
I know, right?
That's a lot of talking.
We should do something special for episode number 52, just because it's the 1 year, and if we can be like, it's the new 52!
I hate you.
You are my arch enemy.
Okay, well, let's see if we can recoup this. It'll be like the new Zoo Review 52, or something like that. You know, we can make it our own, Chris.
The
we
new 50 have, poo?
Let's... Wow, dude, really?
We can do that thing where we make it our own so it's not such a bad thing in our lives.
That's
right?
That the
and then
point?
We can sell it for $90,000.
Exactly.
Yeah, recuperating,
and then DC's
going
to
recapitulate. Yeah.
All right. So anyway, let's talk about Grant Morrison for a bit. Apparently, he's tackling the Mahabharata for Graphic India. And I hope I pronounced that correctly. It's funny. I practice these words before we roll. And then like right when we record, I go brain dead.
Mm-hmm. The way I learned to pronounce it was Mahabharata.
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 Okay.
Now, you know, there have been times in my life where I have been tutored on the pronunciation of something and said it that way for years, and then someone of a native speaker will go, no. So I reserve the right to be wrong in that pronunciation.
Oh, well,
but we
anyway,
we're talking about the great Sanskrit epic.
Yeah, but anyway, 18 days is a lot easier to pronounce.
Yes, it is.
And that's actually what it's called. He's retelling the story as a mythic sci-fi adventure. Has anybody read it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I read the first 0 and 1. Yes.
Zero?
Yeah, they started with number 0 for $1 to try and hook you up into it.
All right. Oh, I just read the number 1.
Oh, okay.
I didn't realize there was a 0, too.
That's the one I was going to try and get you, but I was having trouble getting it.
Oh.
I saw a couple of copies on the shelf over there.
I think that's like number 2.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Because it's a lot of setup, because there's a lot of characters.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of names that I need a scorecard for, because I suck when it comes to this set of mythology. It's so expansive and it's so big, and I was gonna cheat, and I was just like, oh, please have one of them be Team Red and the other Team Blue. That'll make it easy. And then when they show you both sides, you're just like, oh, you got both, God, both you have red on both of you. Okay, I'm gonna really have to make an effort here on these names, but I still really really like it, and I think Cole, you mentioned earlier like the art wasn't quite gelling for
right.
you.
Right, I reviewed issue number 1.
Yeah.
I was oblivious to the fact there was an issue number 0, but we did talk a little bit about the script that they, you know, years ago they'd printed the script of the unproduced script with illustrations.
Yeah.
I'm hopeful. The thing about a lot of those kind of Hindu epics is there are plots within plots within plots within plots, and it gets very confusing because you know, you are encountering different incarnations of a deity. You know, Ram
right.
will be incarnated in Arjuna, or Hana, or an aspect will be incarnated in Hanuman, the Lord of the Monkeys, and they all are part of the same God mind. And I have a terrible time keeping that straight.
Yeah.
And all of these entities have their own stories that go off and in different directions and
who's
wheels
the avatar
the wheels.
Of who
right
yeah, so,
yeah. It's fascinating, but at the same time you have to be a scholar to keep track of it all.
Right.
Maybe that's why Grant Morrison wanted to take this on, because he just loves all that expansive stuff and bringing it all together.
Oh, and he's big in the mythology.
Yeah.
I mean, he tried to fit that into everything he can. I mean,
a lot of great source material back there.
Yeah I mean, even in his Justice League run, he tried to make them the equivalent of the Greek pantheon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not surprising that he wanted to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I really kind of wish that they kept Mukesh Singh as the artist. He's the artist who did the work on the script book, and he does the covers to these, but he's not doing the interiors. And if you look at his artwork, it's amazingly
gorgeous.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just want nothing but posters of 18 days from now on.
Yeah.
But yeah.
What I'm curious about is the choice, the editorial kinds of choices that Morrison is making in what threads of of the epic he's going to isolate, and exactly how long it's going to go. Mm-hmm. You know, it's because it's my understanding is that it's a tale that is retold, but also the beauty of it is that it permutates and evolves and has evolved for centuries. You know, there are dance dramas in Bali in India where they give you a chunk of the story and they will perform them from dusk until dawn for 7 days, and sometimes that's not even the whole story. And the stories are communicated through dance and through mask and through ritualized performance that the people in the communities know and respect and appreciate. But it's also a religious reinscription of their faith. You know, and that's where Morrison walks this weird slippery slope, because, you know, in his book Super Gods, he talks about, you know, how we reinscribe our Western belief systems through comic books. And I'm kind of curious what he's going to be doing with this book, and is it what he's exploring through 18 Days?
Because he's turning it into a sci-fi epic. Like, he's actually, like, reinventing it as this additional sci-fi fantasy.
Right.
And that's in the cover designs. Everything looks a little more techy than you would assume.
Mm-hmm.
But it's supposed to be taking place in the age before our current age. So it's kind of like, oh, okay, so it's kind of like the New Gods. And he has a particular love for Jack Kirby's New Gods, and that's all based on a number of world mythologies, including this one.
Right.
So it's all this giant circle of mythology feeding into mythology and then trying to kick it up a notch with weird sci-fi.
It's what binds us together in human consciousness, I believe, is what he's saying, is that these phases and these worlds and these wheels within wheels, it's all what comprises who we are. And when we understand this story, we'll understand ourselves and our place in the universe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That sounds super Grant Morrison-y.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'll take some extra drugs before doing that and come back to me. Yeah.
What other comics are there based on world mythologies would you recommend?
Michael Avon Oeming, who is the collaborator,
mm-hmm.
yes.
excuse the seizure, with Brian Michael Bendis on Powers, he has a particular love for Norse mythology. I think he lives in Ballard, so that makes a lot of sense.
Cool.
And he did Hammer of the Gods, which was kind of his creator-owned thing for a bit, and that's really cool. He also did a big chunk of Marvel's Thor, where he infused the original Ragnarok mythology with Jack Kirby Thor mythology, and you get this really like high-octane version of Norse mythology, which also features Better Ray Bill, the talking horse alien god. But yeah, so he tends to focus a lot of his other fiction on Norse. So I like to look at Oeming for that.
Cool.
Do you have any others?
Well, I'm always going to default to Neil Gaiman, but Neil Gaiman's gods were his own. I mean, he argued and has argued through his novels and the Sandman comic that we are in a new age of immortal beings that represent our belief systems, and in the endless, you know, all the they're sprung from whole cloth from his imagination. You know, they're all D names. There's dream and desire and destiny and destruction and death, and, you know, and they all are the family.
Dude.
And and they are fascinating characters to me. But he went a step further with his novel American Gods, where he tries to incorporate a whole, you know, pantheon of old gods, recent gods, and then gods of tomorrow, or gods of industry, of pollution and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question, I think the other really interesting discourse on gods is, Gillen and McKelvey, Wilson and Cowles. Well, I guess it's just Gillen and McKelvey, isn't it? It's the Wicked and the Divine from Image, which we'll talk about at Book Report.
Yes.
Another joint Book Report coming up this episode?
Yes, please.
All right. This is triple joint. I am blacking out. I know I've...
Well, there's Bold Riley, which keeps it Indian, I think, as well.
I believe so. I've only read one issue.
Yeah, but I haven't read it so in-depth. But I liked it because it was also a queer comic. Mm.
Are there any straight up, like, Greek or Roman mythology comics which tell the stories in comic form?
There's been a few. There was a really good adaptation of the Odyssey.
So I would have loved that in high school.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a couple really good adaptations, one of the Odyssey. There's a series, I forget the overall arching name of it, but they do one book per god.
Okay.
And I really wish I could remember the name of those books.
We'll send it to me. We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
So. Post-Crisis, George Perez and then John Byrne tried to take Wonder Woman back to Greek mythological roots. I can't say back to her roots from the Golden Age of comics because that really wasn't centered there. They tried to make her more of a divine presence and honor that mythology.
Well, they do that in the new 52 Wonder Woman.
Do they?
Yeah,
with Cliff Chiang and Brian Azzarello.
They changed it up and they revealed that she's flat out Zeus's daughter.
Yeah.
The whole clay mythology is out the window. And so she's actually half brothers and sisters with all the gods, and it sucks because they're all crazy. Mm. I will say one thing I will not recommend is the Avatar book God is Dead. It was created by Jonathan Hickman, but it's one of those, like, he wrote it on a napkin and handed it to somebody kind of deals.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because I saw that on the shelf earlier before we started recording, and now I had Nine Inch Nails running through my head. Oh.
Nice. Yeah, it's not that... conceptually, I kind of liked it. The idea is that all the old pantheons, all of them, Egyptian, Greek, Norse, everybody, even more obscure things, they all come back and they're like, no, we're pretty angry that you're not worshiping us, so we're going to kill a lot of you until you worship us. And then they decide to go in it all at once, and then, of course, they start fighting over territory and over worship. And so then it turns into basically a bad video game where it's like Anubis versus Zeus, and it's like,
player two has entered the game.
But then they do something like Zeus kills him in two panels, and you're like, no, there's a giant story there. You're shortchanging Anubis.
Yeah.
Like, there's a big metaphysical combat thing happening that you're not talking about. I'm sure that's what Hickman wanted, but he's already, like, gone. It's listed as Hickman's book. Yeah, he's getting that little check, but he's not writing it. And each cover has this really cool, like, random monster from different mythologies. It's just like, I want to like you. And then you open a book and you're like, nope. Yeah, so maybe I need to go back and give it another chance. But some of the art... Some of them look like horrible Muppets and not entertaining Muppets.
Epic God
I think if you're doing, epic gods, you would want to have some investment in the art, to make it more interesting.
Yeah.
And there's a concept piece that Warren Ellis did called Super God.
Oh, yeah. Super God, yeah.
Yeah. And that was cool because it was like they actually had Vishnu, I think.
Yeah.
Who... It's just like all these gods from different nations.
But they were created by the nations.
But they were also created by the nations.
Yeah, genetically bred or something.
In the image of the mythological beings.
Bringing about, it was supposed to be for good-ish.
Right. Yeah.
And then it ended up just completely falling apart.
That was a really creepy series, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. So.
Yeah, it was good. It's just a good
little concept piece. And it was Avatar as well, and so I'm making myself a bit of a hypocrite, but it was...
Well,
you enjoyed Avatar?
Yeah.
They had like a Fantastic Four moment where these three astronauts go into space, and then there's like a spore.
They come back as
They come back
god.
As like a triad mushroom god where things you get
they
very intense
pores,
you get
spores.
Very intense urges to do certain things when you're in their presence
because it is Avatar comics
and it's
all about
Ellis.
The urges
well because Warren Ellis also likes to be crass
that's true all about the urges
cool all right. So so that's Grant Morrison in 18 Days and recommendations and non-recommendations of other
everything
mythological world mythologies. Anyway, moving on, let's talk about toys, guys.
Yay.
Because I know that everybody loves collecting their toys. Yes. So
it comes with a little bit of sigh.
I don't know if as many of you have been in Cole's apartment as often as I have.
I have.
So the dude owns a two-bedroom apartment, and one bedroom is completely full of comics, and the other one is full of toys.
There's a guest bed. Thank you, Nicole.
Yeah.
And the other, and it's true. And then the other bedroom is floor to ceiling.
Star Wars.
I'm not making fun of you, dude. I think it's not. I don't want to say admirable. It's impressive. It is.
You know, my friend, you have used the descriptor cluttered on more than one occasion when you visited me.
I think you do a good job with the amount of stuff you have and organizing.
Look,
them.
If you really love me, Ben Lawrence, you'd be over there helping me dust it at least once a month. But, you know, you don't.
All right, you're not. So everybody at this table is a collector, I must say. And, you know, some collect comics, action figures. I collect baseball cards. But let's talk about action figures, because we had this thing a couple of weeks ago called Force Friday, which is when they released the brand new Star Wars toys, and people were lining up for blocks to get the new toys. Did anybody here do that?
No, I did that during, prior to Revenge of the Sith, and, I may have done it, prior to Attack of the Clones, and it just was... By that time, I was getting Star Wars collector fatigue, and I actually didn't even know that the Force Awakens figures were going to be available.
Chris is nodding his head knowingly.
Yeah. But I did find myself, once I realized this, that we'd had Force Friday, and that's what that was, I did actually tootle around about 5 or 6 or 7 different stores. and I was pretty frustrated. I had to resort to eBay, and am still, to try to get the first 16 of the Force Awakens figures.
Because they didn't release enough of them, right?
No, they're very poorly distributed.
Yeah. Which I found in Marvel Legends as well. It's really obnoxious.
You don't think that might have been a ploy to create demand?
Of course it is.
If it is, it's a stupid thing. Because then it goes into the scalpers, it goes into like a secondary third-party market, whatever. And then who cares? Then you don't get the money.
Right.
Don't you want money?
What they want is they want you coming back to the store. Right. And this is what we learned in the 90s when action figures became a more collectible community, became more viable collector's items, in that they would short pack figures, or better yet, there would be a limited female figure. So, like
which
the first
still happens today,
right?
And, stupid.
And the only reason is because boys don't buy girl toys. But the other reason is they want the collectors. They want people coming back to the stores.
But here's the thing: is that they don't restock the shelves. And then you get like 17 of the one figure that nobody wants because they put 3 of them in a case.
Doesn't matter. You're back in the store, and that means you could be buying other things in that store while you're there.
Maybe.
No, that's actually, they've done studies. Right. This is why they're doing it. Well, they're manipulating our minds.
I'm only speaking
commit to the truth.
I would commit to the truth if I was one of those people that actually bought something else. But we go to stores. We don't find the thing. We go home.
Right.
We don't buy other things. I Google all the things and then go, well, that's it, and go home.
But that is not typical of your average store-going person. I mean, somebody's in a store. And I feel that urge. I mean, if I go to a store for something specific, I'm like, oh, well, they don't have it. Oh, what else do they have? I could use that
with food.
Yeah.
Because I want to eat all the things.
Yeah. They got you into the store. You're that much closer to buying something.
I guess.
I get it. And it's also just dumb because it doesn't always work in my personal experience of that.
Right. Well, nobody said it was a smart...
Nobody said capitalism was smart.
Short packing the females, they need to stop doing that.
Well, but I see...
That's driving me crazy!
I agree, but I'm impressed with the frequency of female figures in action figure lines.
They are doing a lot more.
You know?
I mean, we got a Spider-Woman, we've gotten Captain Marvel, got a Spider-Gwen slated.
There's the Marvel Legends that's all the spider characters. I think there is many female spider characters as there are male, or
there
maybe
are
more.
A lot.
And
there's
really
a lot
impressed
of spider
with
people,
that.
Though.
Yeah, I was really. But I mean, the frequency of just that many female superhero action figures, I thought was awesome.
Yeah.
I will say though, we got like some of the new Star Wars black figures.
Yes.
And there's one Princess Leia Organa as the Boosh or whatever from whatever when she had the mask on in Jabba's place. And there's
Boosh, like the bounty hunter.
That one, yes.
Yoto.
But there's there's no other females in the entire line of I think we got.
Well, there's C-3PO. I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Hey, now.
But then there's like John Dude guy, this pilot who died 3 seconds in.
Right.
You know,
John
I can't
Dude
say him.
Guy.
Yeah. And then
I
like Ugnaga.
John Dude
yeah,
guy.
They're on John Dude guy. Yeah, they're
the
just on the water.
3¾-inch.
Yeah,
have
they're the little guys.
The little guys. Oh. Yeah.
I have to say the C-3PO, even though I just made a misogynistic joke at him. I actually think he's really cool figure.
Cole really wants to go see.
I didn't realize you had
wall.
Him over there. No, I've been working on that
down,
line. It's frustrating.
Down there.
Go ahead, go take a look. You know you want
no,
to.
No, I'm doing the podcast right now. I'm not going to go palm through the toys right now.
Yes. So.
So this is supposed to be about debunking the myth of.
I think we're doing a fine job of that. So yeah, one of the topics in bringing this up was debunking the myth that toy collecting is for kids, and I mean we're all adults, and
maybe
some of us. By age, maybe not by maturity.
I do work in a comic book store, but okay.
So. The other question I wanted to ask, we got a lot of great things we're talking about here, but the other one of the questions I wanted to ask is, what's your white whale in terms of toy collecting? What's that one thing that you've been looking for that you just can't find, or if you find it, it's way too out of your price range? Because in personally, when I collect baseball cards, I collected during a certain set of years where the market just flopped, and it's still that way. But there are those certain cards within those sets that, like, there's one card in 1990 Topps. It's the Frank Thomas No Name on Front. It was a printing error, and there's like five of them. Right, they're $800 a pop. You know, if you can find one that's not a counterfeit. You know, and every once in a while I scour eBay to see if somebody has one on hand that they don't know what they have, know?
Yeah.
What are there the equivalent of that in terms of action figure collection?
Sure.
With Star Wars, I'll just go Star Wars because that's the most complete exhaustive collection I have. In the vintage lines, there were Kenner. This is when Kenner was producing the toys. There was a Droids, and there was a Ewoks animated series, and there was a line of figures from both of those that sold very, very poorly. And I remember seeing them cleared out at KB Toys for 99 cents a pop for like 5 years. They warmed the pegs, but there were like five figures that never were sold in the States, and I can't remember the name of the figure, but there were other subsidiary toy companies and distributors overseas, and one of them was called Glasslight. And Glasslight had one Droids animated series figure that was sold in Italy. And that is actually worth more than, say, the vinyl Cape Jawa or Luke and or Ben or Darth Vader with the original telescoping lightsabers.
I had that.
Yeah. But I actually found a dealer selling bootleg molds of this character.
Nice.
And I was like totally happy to pay $100 for this casting of this figure because the actual figure itself is like $4,000 on the card.
Crazy.
But I got, and I can't remember his name, but yeah.
Yeah. What's yours?
Mine is the exclusive Shadow Weaver from the Masters of the Universe line.
Whoa.
In the 2000s. She was an exclusive, I think, a San Diego, or maybe it was a Maddie Collector thing. I think it was a Maddie Collector thing.
Uh-huh.
And when I was looking at her, I think she was at the lowest $80, which I just didn't have free to spend. She's probably more now. But I love Shadow Weaver. She's come on. She's great. She's awful. And I want her.
Needs her. No surprise, mine is a Transformer.
Yeah.
Omega Supreme, the original Omega Supreme, was a working space shuttle train set. He was huge, and basically when you transformed him, there was like a circular track with a tank that would roll around it, you know, with a battery, and then in the center was the space shuttle. And when you put him back into his robot mode, the space shuttle was like a cannon and a claw, and he's like this giant guy, and his name is Omega Frickin' Supreme, which is like, yes, more.
The frickin's not in there.
I should be.
The frickin'.
I had that.
Oh, you
I had
that.
I think I still have parts of it in a box somewhere.
Nice.
Maybe I'll bring it in next week.
Maybe. I never had him.
What I love is the joy I've been watching you experience, Chris, because Chris, he's been getting these reproductions of the Transformer figures, and this is like after my time. I didn't grow up with Transformers the way, or Masters of the Universe the way Ben and Chris did, and Nicole. But
this is my childhood right here.
Yeah,
Chris is now fondling a Transformer.
This is actually,
you know,
I think, my favorite Transformer that you've gotten thus far.
I didn't realize that these are reproductions. I thought these were new characters or new releases, but these are meticulous reproductions of the original toys.
Reproductions, more posability, but they still kind of have that classic feel, kind of the blocky feel. Uh-huh. But they add in things that are from the current comics, too, because this Ultra Magnus, there's kind of an in-joke. The original toy was just, he was a repainted Optimus Prime, and you shoved him into a big piece of armor, and he was a bigger guy now. So in the comics, they've actually explained that the Ultra Magnus you see is just a giant suit of armor that this teeny little guy called like a heavy load bearer can carry. He's like an ant. And so Ultra Magnus is really this teeny, teeny little guy. And so the toy now has a teeny little guy that transforms into a car, but you could shove him inside the chest of Ultra Magnus and he pilots it like and a Jaeger.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Great.
Yeah, it's a...
Great.
He was an exact replica of Optimus Prime, and whereas Optimus Prime pulled like a box trailer, Ultra Magnus pulled a car carrier.
Yeah, so it's even more meta now because he's got a little car to put into the car trailer.
So is this not a reproduction of a toy that was produced in the 80s or the 90s? Because you're making it sound like there have been amendments to this.
There's amendments. I mean, it's a reproduction of the core design, but it's amended,
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's some cheating going on here.
Yeah, there's some cheating.
All right. Updated.
It's Robotception, so it's pretty awesome.
All right, so we got to move on.
In disguise.
But for those listening, if you're a toy collector, action figure collector, you shouldn't feel ashamed. All right, toy collector. I think it's legit to call it toy collectors.
No problem.
All right, so let's move on to book report, everybody. Cole Hornaday, what have you been reading this week?
Well, I wanted to, in keeping with the theme of gods and comics, I read both volumes of Gillen and McKelvey's The Wicked and the Divine, both trades that range from, issues,
something through something.
Yes, the first volume is...
I think it's 1 through 12. I think it's 6 issues each.
Okay, great. Yeah. Because there's been a... The ongoing comic book is very popular, and I was really curious about it. I enjoyed it for what it was, but... I did, in talking with it before we started recording, talking with Nicole and Chris about, what makes this Gods Among Us concept so popular now, as opposed to in the 90s when Neil Gaiman was exploring his Endless through Sandman. This story is, it's a slow wind-up. Like, the first volume, I enjoyed it because we focus on the Lucifer character,
right?
Yeah.
The female Lucifer. She's a fascinating and fun character.
Yes.
But everything else kind of like falls in the background. And we do have a human supporting character, Laura.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Laura is actually who we...
fangirl.
Yeah.
Of the pop stars.
Well, let's give kind of the background.
Yeah.
The gods have returned, but what's interesting is that in these gods returning, being reincarnated in human bodies...
They arrive every 90 years. It's
right.
a cycle.
Right.
And in the current incarnation, they're all pop stars.
Right.
They're all... It's Beyonce. What if Beyonce and Jay-Z were gods?
They're all musicians.
They're all musicians.
Yes. Only have 2 years, and then they die.
Right.
Yes.
Because they burn out the human bodies.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And their identities are kind of fused with the human bodies that they conform to. But the other thing that kind of puzzled me is that it's not one pantheon.
Right.
There are gods from Asian faiths and Hindu and Greek and Roman and
Norse and all that.
Just kind of like, they're kind of randomly poached from these different cultures. And there's no real explanation for this. And that kind of puzzled me.
I think they'll get to it because McKelvey? No, that's the artist.
Gillen.
Kieran Gillen.
I've read some stuff of his where he's got a very slow turnout for the final plot element.
Sure.
And I kind of get the feeling he wants to build this story up kind of the same Neil Gaiman levels. You know, like let's make it more intricate and give you all these things to make you wonder what's really happening. Because it is one giant murder mystery.
Right.
And kind of a whodunit mixed in with a conspiracy.
Right.
So, definitely conspiracy.
Yeah.
There's... though all the other gods will burn out, there's one central female goddess, like they are, that seems to be the linchpin of the whole thing, maybe even the puppeteer of the whole story.
Yeah, the caretaker of the cycles.
Is that Anunnaki? What's is that?
Yeah, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but okay. I thought it was Anaki.
Okay, but she... her costume really looks like she's very spider-like, and so I'm almost getting this impression that she's the spider at the center of the web.
Yeah.
But she's the one who seems to activate the gods, and but also outlives them.
She does. Yeah. She said that she's seen all of these cycles, yeah. And you actually, I think it's in the second volume, you get more of her story, just a little bit of a flourish, and that's where you get that maybe she is that spider at the center of the web. Sure. Like, what is it that she's plotting? Because clearly she's got intentions while she's just letting the gods just run amok and do stupid things. And
I've enjoyed the books quite a bit. I will keep following it, but I got to tell you, I appreciate them a lot more in the trade collections. Yeah. I think I would have gotten frustrated with reading it a month to month. I don't think I could have committed, but it's going to take. It's going to take some effort for it to exceed my enjoyment of the Neil Gaiman stories, but mm-hmm. that's because I'm fogey and stuck in my ways.
And I think it's also the cycle element because sure. we are hitting this next generation of readers that don't want to backtrack. They want something right now, right here,
fresh
whatever,
and new,
with tweets and, new, yeah. and current references.
Right,
you know?
And actually, that's what a lot of what this comic book says about culture. So it's smart little book.
It's a pop culture version of mm-hmm. Gaiman. Yeah.
So were you two going to do a combined book report this month?
No.
They
were just helping
kind
me.
Kind of the three of us. So it depends. If we're low on time, that could have been the triple review.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine. Or we can do more.
We can do... What about you, Nicole? What did you read?
I read a while ago, Sunstone Volume 1.
Okay.
But I'd kind of put off reviewing it because I have so many feels about it. I was going to go on for 3 hours.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
So now I'm a little separated. I could maybe do a few minutes.
Okay.
A little distance. So Sunstone is about two women who find each other online who are into S&M, which is a sexual side thing that people do. Look it up if you don't know what it is. And, maybe, you know.
Don't do a Google image
unless you're a kid.
And don't do it at work.
Yeah, not safe for work, not safe for kids. So this is a mature title. It's written and drawn by Stefan
John Sejic.
He's Croatian. So if there's any Croatian listeners who can help me with that, that'd be great. So Lisa is this amateur writer. She does erotica. And Allie, she invested in the internet stuff, I don't know, AOL, let's just say, and just made a lot of money off of it. And she's got this big mansion full of toys. And they find each other through Lisa's writing online, talk for months and months, realize that, hey, I think we're actually aligned in this way, and maybe we should meet up. And then it ends up depicting their relationship. The first volume is just their basic meeting and the blossoming of feelings for each other. Allie has this one friend who she used to be with, but is now, because they're both doms, it didn't work. So now she just calls him every time she needs to talk about something and is super giddy. It's basically just this rom-com of their relationship. And it's so sweet and so adorable. And you have things.
it's a kinky nerd rom-com.
It is totally cool. A kinky nerd rom-com.
Because like one of them's like super gamer, and they're just big geeks who blush a lot when they're near each other.
A lot.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're in the back of the first volume, he talks about his whole process of it, because it was just this, he was burnt out on doing comics, and he just started posting things on his DeviantArt of this triad of girls who got together in kinky ways. And then it flourished into a story because everyone started asking, well, what's their story? What's going on? And I just really like reading all of that in the back. He said that about the romance, like it's an amazing thing about writing romance. You start realizing just how much logic is chucked out of the window. And then when we're secretly in love, we make mistakes, we make stupid decisions, we justify them with the dumbest of reasons. And these reasons make sense at the time. They make perfect sense to us, but to everyone around us, you know, it's just pissing everybody off and they're deluded and everything. So it's just all about humanity and interpersonal relationships. It's just super endearing. I love it.
How would you describe the artwork?
Arty,
would you say digitally painted?
Yeah, I think it's digitally painted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he does different things with layouts too. When he put it into print, he changed some things up. I tried looking at the DeviantArt, and it's just a mess to try to figure out what the story is. So he really did do a lot of work in it. And the coloring is very, very much digitally colored, for sure.
I do notice in a lot of modern comics like this, they go, it's a very cinematic look, and they do a lot of, like, depth of field panels where, you know, the foreground is in focus and the background's out of focus or vice versa. It's very cool.
Yeah, and they definitely do some things like that. So anyway, I cannot recommend this enough. Like, I know there's a question of what would you not recommend to a new reader? And yeah. I said Sunstone, because when I tell people it's about two girls who are into S&M, people just, their faces contort in these weird ways. But then when you tell them a little bit more about the humanity and the rom-com aspect and the sweetness of it, it just is like, why not read it? Like, mm-hmm. You should totally read it.
Cool. All right. Sunstone. Chris, you have something you want to bring up?
Are we good on time?
Yeah, why not?
Okay.
why not?
I have been reading this series called Surface Tension from Titan Comics. And it's underwater sci-fi horror, kind of. It's I love the art style. It's written and drawn by this guy named Jay Gunn. That's just his pen name. And it reminds me of Brian Talbot, who's one of my favorite artists. He did The Adventures of Luther Arkwright, mm-hmm. has worked with Neil Gaiman on a number of projects. And the core idea is that these giant coral reef towers started to show up one day in the middle of the ocean everywhere. And people started to hear a calling, and they went out to the water like zombies, and they started mm-hmm. to dissolve. They started to liquefy into these putrid shapes. And like 99% of the world population disappears that day. And then weird creatures start coming out of the ocean, like dinosaur-looking monsters and really weird but cute but ugly seal things. And so two people come back from the ocean, and they've changed incredibly. Like, they're bluish and other weird things. And a giant monster comes out too, and it kind of wants to get those two. So there's something
conflict
happening. Yes. It's just a really interesting mix of horror and sci-fi. And
now, Titan is that's a British publisher, right? Or yeah, European publisher?
They do the Doctor Who comics right now, right. And they have been importing a lot of things. I think I reviewed another book they just translated called The Voyages of Lone Sloan. So they're doing a range of different things, which I really like. So yeah, it's just interesting sci-fi, nice art, weird monsters.
Do you know, is it an ongoing series or is it going to be limited?
It's going to be limited. Okay. He's definitely got an arc going on here. Okay. I think it's total of 6 issues is what he's doing.
The artwork looks great.
Yeah.
The story sounds really fun.
And he's worked on video game projects. I just found out. Like, I was trying to figure out what else he's done, and it's mostly video game designs for monsters.
What?
So it's like, oh, look at that. So, yeah.
All right. Surface Tension. Well, that's Book Report, and that's our show. But before we go, of course, we play quiz time. Get your quiz hats on, everybody. This week, our quiz questions come to us from Mr. Cole Hornaday. Lay it on us, man.
And the theme of trivia this week is dogs in comics.
You're now my favorite person.
All right.
Which is no small feat. He broke up with me earlier today.
Yes. Oh, first off, here we go. Introducing the Silver Age of DC Comics, who was Batman's cowled canine companion? Mr. Cousseau.
Rex the Wonder Dog?
No. Let's try Ace the Bat Hound. Ace the Bat Hound. Okay, yeah, I'm gonna give you a second chance in this one, because this is a sequel question. Son of Batman, Damian Wayne has a dog as well in the contemporary storylines. Named for William Shakespeare's bloodiest play. What's the name of Damian's dog?
Titus.
Very good, yes. Very good. Though he appeared in many different eras of the Marvel Universe, including the all-new, all-different line, Red Wolf has always had a canine companion named what? Hint, he shares a name with the DCU anti-hero, also known as the last Zarnian, you crazy bastich.
Lobo?
Yes, Lobo. We are speaking our own language here.
Yes,
right?
Yes, you are.
Okay, I'm going to go a little bit off the comic book beam, but not entirely. In the 1960s, who was teen super spy and world-renowned adventurer Johnny Quest's diminutive doggy pal?
It's not Duke? No.
God, you guys are breaking my heart.
I know, it's a little puggy guy.
Can I phone my mom?
Is she your lifeline?
She's
Bandit.
My lifeline.
Bandit was Johnny Quest's doggy. Okay, lastly, this is going to be practically a gimme. Not to be outdone, the Silver Age of DC Comics also introduced a superpowered pup into the Man of Steel's life. What was the name of Superman's dog?
Crypto.
Crypto the Super Dog. Aww. Absolutely. First appeared in Superboy and Action Comics number 210 in 1955.
Crypto the Super Dog. Crypto. All right. Well, thank you,
also,
Cole.
You're welcome. Not a dog, but Bat Cow. Yes. I love that.
Yep. Bat Cow. I considered having a gimme Bat Cow question, but no.
Next time.
All right. Well, that's our show. And thank you for listening. You can find us every week at perfectboundpodcast.com. You can also subscribe to us via iTunes or any RSS reader of your choice. You can also see everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com. You can also come to the Comics Dungeon, 319 Northeast 45th Street, here in beautiful downtown Wallingford, Washington, in the neighborhood of Seattle, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.